not even a message. How could she do this? At worst, Enrique figures he can break away, run. But the smugglers call again. She says she has sent the money through a female immigrant who lives with her, because the woman gets a Western Union discount. The money should be there under the woman's name. It is. Enrique has no time to celebrate. The smugglers take him to a gas station, where they meet another man in the network. He puts Enrique with four immigrant men being routed to Orlando, Florida. They stay overnight in Houston, and at midday, Enrique leaves Texas in a green van. 5 days later, Lourdes's boyfriend gets time off from work to drive to Orlando, where Enrique has been staying with other immigrants and waiting for him to arrive. Her boyfriend is handsome, with broad shoulders, graying temples, and a mustache. Enrique recognizes him from a video his Uncle Carlos brought back from a visit. "Are you Lourdes's son?" the boyfriend asks. Enrique nods. "Let's go." They say little in the car, and Enrique falls asleep. By 8 a.m. on May 28th, Enrique is in North Carolina. He awakens to tires crossing highway seams. Click, 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 click. "Are we lost?" he asks. "Are you sure we aren't lost? Do you know where we are going?" "We're almost there." They are moving fast through pines and elms, past billboards and fields, yellow lilies and purple lilacs. The road is freshly paved. It goes over a bridge and passes cattle pastures with large rolls of hay. On both sides are wealthy subdivisions, then railroad tracks. Finally, at the end of a short gravel street, some house trailers. One is beige. Built in the 1950s, it has white metal awnings and is framed in tall green trees. At 10 a.m., after more than 12,000 miles, 122 days, and 7 futile attempts to get to his mother, Enrique, 11 years older than when she left him behind, bounds from the back seat of the car and up 5 faded redwood steps, and swings open the white door of the mobile home. To the left, beyond a tiny living room with dark wooden beams, sits a girl with shoulder-length black hair and curly bangs. She is at the kitchen table eating breakfast. He remembers a picture of her. Her name is Diana. She is 9 now. Enrique leans over and kisses the girl on the cheek. "Are you my brother?" He nods. "Where's my mother? Where's my mother?" She motions past the kitchen to the far end of the trailer. Enrique runs. His feet zigzag down 2 narrow, brown-paneled hallways. He opens a door. Inside, the room is cluttered, dark. On a queen-size bed, under a window draped with lace curtains, his mother is asleep. He jumps squarely onto the bed next to her. He gives her a hug, then a kiss. "You're here, mi hijo." "I'm here," he says. A twist. The Odyssey, an epic poem about a hero's journey home from war, ends with reunion and peace. The Grapes of Wrath, the classic novel about the Dust Bowl and the migration of Oklahoma farmers to California, ends with death and a glimmer of renewed life. Enrique's journey is not fiction, and its conclusion is more complex and less dramatic. But it ends with a twist worthy of O. Henry. Children like Enrique dream of finding their mothers and living happily ever after. For weeks, perhaps months, these children and their mothers cling to romanticized notions of how they should feel toward each other. Then reality intrudes. The children show resentment because they were left behind. They remember broken promises to return and accuse their mothers of lying. They complain that their mothers work too hard to give them the attention they have been missing. In extreme cases, they find love and esteem elsewhere, by getting pregnant, marrying early, or joining gangs. Some are surprised to discover entire new families in the United States. A stepfather, stepbrothers, and stepsisters. jealousies grow. Stepchildren call the new arrivals mojados, or wetbacks, and to gain power over their new siblings, threaten to summon U.S. immigration authorities. The mothers, for their part, demand respect for their sacrifice, leaving their children for the children's sake. Some have been lonely and worked hard to support themselves, to pay off their own smuggling debts, and save money to send home. When their children say, "You abandoned me," they respond by hauling out tall stacks of money transfer receipts. They think their children are ungrateful and bristle at the independence they show. The same independence that helped the children survive their journeys north. In time, mothers and children discover they hardly know each other. At first, neither Enrique nor Lourdes cries. He kisses her again. She holds him tightly. He has played this out in his mind 1,000 times. It is just as he thought it would be. All day they talk. He tells her about his travels, the clubbing on top of a train, leaping off to save his life, the hunger, thirst, and fear. He has lost 28 pounds and is down to 107. She cooks rice, beans, and fried pork. He sits at the table and eats. The boy she last saw when he was in kindergarten is taller than she is. He has her nose, her round face, her eyes, her curly hair. Lourdes has 3 children, but Enrique is special. He is her only son. "Look, Mom, look what I put here." He pulls up his shirt. She sees a tattoo. "Enrique Lourdes," it says across his chest. His mother winces. "Tattoos," she says, "are for delinquents, for people in jail." "I'm going to tell you, son, I don't like this." She pauses. "But at least if you had to get a tattoo, you remembered me." "I've always remembered you." He tells her about Honduras, how he stole his aunt's jewelry to pay drug debts, how he sold the shoes and clothes she sent to buy glue, how he wanted to get away from drugs, how he ached to be with her. Finally, Lourdes cries. She asks about Belki, her daughter in Honduras, her own mother, and the deaths of 2 of her brothers. Then she stops. She feels too guilty to go on. The trailer is awash in guilt. 8 people live here. Several have left their children behind. All they have is pictures. Lourdes's boyfriend has 2 sons in Honduras. He has not seen them in 5 years. One of the boyfriend's cousins left behind a wife and son, 2 months old. He has not seen them in 2 years. Another cousin and her husband left behind a 4-year-old daughter. The husband has never seen the daughter. His wife was pregnant when he left. She calls every 2 weeks and vows to return to Honduras in 1 year if she hasn't been able to bring their daughter north. "The most important thing is love. Not losing that," she says. 3 pictures of the little girl in a pink shirt and pigtails stand as a constant reminder near a television in a corner. Enrique likes the people in the trailer, especially his mother's boyfriend. He could be a better father than his own dad, who abandoned him 10 years ago to start another family. In Honduras, Enrique's grandmother walks next door to talk to Enrique's girlfriend, Maria Isabel. She has news. Enrique made it. Maria Isabel wails. "He's not coming back." She locks herself in her bedroom and cries for 2 hours. For the next few months, Maria Isabel spends hours at a time silently sitting on a rock in front of her Aunt Gloria's house. At night, Gloria hears Maria Isabel sobbing. Gloria's daughter tries to console Maria Isabel. At least now, the daughter tells her, she's sure Enrique is alive. "Cheer up," she says. "He's there. He'll send money. If he'd stayed, you would have both died of hunger." But Maria Isabel, normally always giggling, is serious and sad. Belki, too, is depressed. She stops talking. In the morning, she cries before facing each new day. She longs to be with her mother. Maybe, she tells herself, she should have gone with her brother, taken the risk. Now both Enrique and Diana are with her mother. Now I'm the only one left here, she tells her aunt, Rosa Amalia. 3 days after Enrique arrives, Lourdes's boyfriend helps him find work as a painter. He earns $7 an hour. Within a week, he is promoted to sander, making $9.50. With his first paycheck, he offers to pick up $50 of the food bill. He buys Diana a gift, a pair of pink sandals for $5.97. He sends money to Belki and to his girlfriend in Honduras. Lourdes brags to her friends. This is my son. Look at him. He's so big. It's a miracle he's here. Whenever he leaves the house, she hugs him. When she comes home from work, they sit on the couch, watching her favorite soap opera, with her hand resting on his arm. Each Sunday they go shopping together to buy enough food to last the week. Lourdes cooks for Enrique, and he begins to put on weight. Over time, though, they realize they are strangers. Neither knows the other's likes or dislikes. At a grocery store, Lourdes reaches for bottles of Coke. Enrique says he does not drink Coke, only Sprite. He plans to work and make money. She wants him to study English, learn a profession. At first, he is quiet and shy. That begins to change. He goes to a pool hall without asking permission. She becomes upset. Occasionally, he uses profanities. She tells him not to. No, Mommy, he says. No one is going to change me. Well, you'll have to change. If not, we'll have problems. I want a son who, when I say to do something, he says, okay. You can't tell me what to do. The clash culminates several weeks after Enrique arrives, when Maria Isabel telephones Collect, and her call is rejected because some of the immigrants in the trailer do not know who she is. That was right, Lourdes says. They cannot afford Collect calls from just anyone. Enrique flares and begins to pack. Enrique says, who are you to me? I don't even know you. Lourdes is enraged. She grabs him by his arm and pulls him into the privacy of her bedroom. You will respect me, she yells. I am your mother. Lourdes blames Enrique's grandmother, Maria. She spoiled the boy and let him run amok. Lourdes is determined to impose discipline on her son. She walks up behind him and spanks him hard on his buttocks several times. You have no right to hit me. You didn't raise me. He tells her that only his grandmother Maria, who raised him, has that right. Lourdes disagrees. I sent money. I supported you. That is raising you. Enrique locks himself in the bathroom and sobs. He throws about anything he can find, toothpaste, shampoo, a perfume bottle. Diana rushes into the bedroom crying. Enrique storms out of the house. Lourdes's boyfriend and his cousin try to calm her. They cruise the streets, trying to find Enrique. Enrique hides behind a small Baptist church 2 miles away. He sleeps in the graveyard behind the church, between the headstones. Lourdes stays up most of the night. What she worries will be her future with Enrique. The next afternoon, however, their love prevails. Enrique returns home and apologizes to his mother. He tells her he loves her. He comforts her with a little white lie. He tells her he spent the night safely sleeping in her car. They share hugs and kisses. That night, they watch soap operas together on the living room sofa. As they sit side by side, Lourdes can feel her son's love. Enrique and his mother are conciliatory at last. More than that, they might be joined by Maria Isabel. One day, Enrique phones Honduras. Maria Isabel is pregnant, as he suspected before he left. On November 2nd, 2000, she gives birth to their daughter. She and Enrique name the baby Catherine Jasmine. The baby looks like him. She has his mouth, his nose, his eyes. An aunt urges Maria Isabel to go to the United States alone. The aunt promises to take care of the baby. If I have the opportunity, I'll go, Maria Isabel says. I'll leave my baby behind. Enrique agrees. We'll have to leave the baby behind. 7. The girl left behind. Enrique knows he does not hate his mother, but with each passing day his resentment grows. After months with his mother, he can no longer contain it. He tells Lourdes she didn't care enough about her children to stay with them in Honduras. Did she think sending money could substitute for having his mother at his side? Or quell the loneliness he felt being moved from one relative to the next? Money doesn't solve anything, he tells her. He berates Lourdes for leaving him with a father she knew was irresponsible. Why didn't she put him with her own family who cared for his sister Belki? Why didn't she send enough money, thus forcing him to sell spices from the age of 10? Why did she send Belki so much more, to cover tuition at a private school her aunt sent her to? Belki always got more from you, he says. If he was destitute, he had no one nearby who could help. How could I ask you for anything, he asks Lourdes. I would go a year without talking to you. He tells her he wanted to study. He just didn't want to have to beg his mother for the money. Belki is going to be a professional. Look at me, he says. Enrique tells Lourdes her biggest mistake was getting pregnant a year after arriving in the United States. You shouldn't have gotten pregnant until you knew your existing kids were okay, he says. Why did she continually promise to return for Christmas and then never show up? Once she knew he was in trouble sniffing glue, he asks her. How could she stay away? You left me, abandoned me, he tells her. You forgot about me. Nothing, he tells her, was gained by their long separation. People come here to prosper. You have nothing here. What have you accomplished? If she had stayed in Honduras, he would have turned out better. I wouldn't be this way if I had had two parents. A true mother, he tells Lourdes, isn't the person who carries you in her womb. It is someone who raises and nurtures you. My mother is my grandmother, Maria, he tells her. He warns Lourdes that she has no right to give him advice. You long ago lost the right to tell me what to do, he says. Then Enrique lands the most hurtful blow. He tells Lourdes he plans to leave her and return to Honduras in 2 years. I'm not going to do the same as you, stay here all my life. Lourdes expected Enrique to love her like the 5-year-old who clung to her in Honduras. She cries herself to sleep at night. She has been a good person, a good mother. Why is God punishing her? She must show Enrique he is terribly mistaken. What about the money I sent you, she says. I have witnesses. Whenever he asked for something specific, a television, a soccer ball, she sent it. Belki got more money only because her aunt lobbied Lourdes for funds for Belki's school tuition. Lourdes lived through extreme poverty and humiliating circumstances to send as much as possible to her children. For the first time, she tells Enrique about the struggles she too endured during their years apart. I killed myself trying to help you. She's not like some mothers she knows, who leaves Honduras and forget their children, never call, never write. That's a mother a child can resent, even hate. I called, I wrote, she says. Blame your father, Lourdes says. He promised to take care of you while I was away. He abandoned you. Your father's family had equal responsibility to provide your needs. Instead, she says angrily, your grandmother Maria sent you to sell spices in the market, where you learned about drugs. You are what you are because you didn't want to study, Lourdes says. It's not my fault. I wanted you to study. You preferred to be on drugs. One night, as he sits down to dinner, Lourdes tells her son that if she had sent more money, he would have blown it on drugs. He sold the bed she bought him for drug money. Enrique, silent, pushes away from the table without touching his food. He should thank her for giving him life, Lourdes says. That alone gives her the right to give him advice and discipline. Lourdes thinks of how her own mother couldn't provide enough food for her children, how she could hate her too. When she was 8 years old, Lourdes sought out odd jobs. A neighbor gave her clothes to wash in the river twice a week. When she was 9, her mother dispatched Lourdes and Rosa Amalia, then 10, to work for a former neighbor as live-in maids. With no money, Lourdes quit elementary school. When she was 14, her mother sent her to live with her eldest brother Marco in southern Honduras. "My mother is sacred to me. I thank her for the little she did for us," Lourdes says. Enrique is harboring a silly resentment, she tells him. She didn't forget him. Why can't she get him to reason? He's an ungrateful brat. Lourdes gives her son a dark prediction. God is going to punish you, she says. Someday, she tells him, your daughter will treat you the way you now treat me. Enrique drinks more and more beer. Their fights are often sparked by Lourdes's advice. Don't drink and drive. Control your vices. Be more frugal. You can't spend $1,000 as if it were $10. Mira, hijo, look, son, she begins. Enrique cuts her off. All you do is yap, yap, yap. You keep sticking your nose into things that are none of your business, he tells her. She treats him as if he were still the infant she left behind. Didn't he fend for himself growing up? Didn't he hop freight trains across Mexico? Shut up, leave me in peace, he yells. Friends worry. They hear hatred in his voice. Enrique loves to contradict his mother to set her off, even when he knows she is right. He talks over her. He leaves his clothes and shoes strewn in the living room, empty beer cans on the front lawn. He tells Lourdes he's going out, then refuses to tell her where. Enrique makes Lourdes mad and guilty. She cooks his dinners. She packs his lunch. She washes his clothes at the laundromat. She drops off his car and insurance payments for him. She lends Enrique $20 here and there. More if he needs it. Would he have turned out different, she asks herself repeatedly, if she hadn't left him? For Enrique, alcohol is an escape from the fights. Almost all of the men on his paint crew, depressed to be away from home, are big drinkers. Unlike in Honduras, in the United States, beer is cheap. Some sip Budweiser on the job, stashing the cans in an empty paint bucket when the supervisor stops by. Most swing by a store to pick up a 12-pack at the end of the workday. At home, 4 men drink. One can chug 12 beers as Enrique drives him home from work. Enrique sucks down 10 beers on weeknights, often with friends in front of the house. He goes to bed at midnight or 1 a.m., getting up at 6 a.m. for work. On Saturday, the drinking begins at 4 p.m. Enrique and a housemate can down 48 beers together. Sometimes they drink until dawn. They head to work without sleeping. Enrique is breaking a promise he made to leave his addictions behind once he crossed into the United States. But he feels abnormal, as if he were crawling out of his skin if he isn't high. At least he's not sniffing glue. Going out to drink gets him out of the trailer, where 9 people live, and Enrique must sleep on the living room sofa. It also gets him away from Lourdes. From Thursday through Sunday in the evenings, he goes to a local bar, a gray stucco building with plywood over the windows and a gravel parking lot. Inside, under a dark, low-slung ceiling, there are 4 pool tables, a long bar, and a jukebox that plays Latino music. He frequents a discotheque with a $7 entry fee. There are iron bars over the door. Inside, the walls are painted black. Next to the dance floor, a DJ plays norteña and ranchera music. Green and red lights cast a glow over the crowd. 8 women work as ficheras, Latinas who will sit and talk to men willing to buy them $10 beers. 6 beers buys 2 hours of companionship, $5 a dance. A few ficheras provide sex for more. Enrique and his friends splurge at a topless bar. Women dance on a platform. Men tuck dollar bills into their bikini bottoms. $20 buys an invitation to a smaller room, where a dancer brushes her breasts against the men's faces. A lap dance is more. Enrique usually spends $150 each visit. One night, he invites his friends to this bar, which charges $15 each to get in. And he pays for everything. He blows $300. When he has money for drinks and marijuana, Enrique is calm and quiet. Otherwise, he gets testy. Sometimes Enrique doesn't have enough money to pay Lourdes his share of the bills. He isn't sending as much money to his daughter as he could. Lourdes tries to scare Enrique straight, playing on his ignorance of the United States. "If you keep this up," she warns, "I'll have you locked up." She tells him that parents can do that in the United States, even if children haven't committed a crime. Enrique soon learns that Lourdes is lying. 4 months after Enrique arrives in the United States, his work hours get cut. He decides to accompany a painter on his crew to find temporary jobs in South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia. Even on the road, living out of motel rooms, Enrique maintains one ritual. Each Sunday, he telephones his girlfriend, Maria Isabel, in Honduras. She waits for his call at the home of one of Lourdes's cousins. When she answers the telephone, she is so overcome with emotion, she cannot speak. Enrique talks for 1 or 2 hours. Maria Isabel cries and cries. "Maria Isabel, say something, anything," Enrique pleads. "I miss you. I love you. Don't forget me," she says. He sends her $100 or more a month. He vows he will be back in Honduras within 2 years. Eventually, Maria Isabel tells him of some of the problems she too is having. Enrique's family constantly criticizes her. "Don't pay attention to them," he tells her. "It is not that easy," she says. Maria Isabel lives across the street from Enrique's grandmother, sister, and 3 aunts. When she was 8 months pregnant, one of Enrique's uncles insinuated that the baby didn't belong to Enrique. Lourdes prepares for Enrique's return and their first Christmas together again. She has grown to dread the holiday. Year after year, she promised Enrique and Belki she would see them for Christmas. Each time she let them down. Each Christmas she cried and became more hard-hearted. She wished that Christmas would never arrive. This year, paying Enrique's smuggler has left her strapped for money. She puts up a small plastic Christmas tree. She crowds it with ornaments. "What an ugly tree," Enrique says. "You put so many things on it that it looks like a piñata." In Honduras, his aunt had a real tree. She set up a nativity scene with hay inside her house. There were fireworks. The whole family gathered at midnight for a special meal. On Christmas Eve, Lourdes goes to bed early. Enrique goes out drinking with friends. He comes home late and drunk. The next morning, Lourdes gives her son a shirt. Enrique doesn't have a gift for his mother. New Year's Eve is better. Lourdes has never celebrated New Year's Eve in the United States. It brings back too many memories of Honduras, where she would run home from a party at midnight to hug her mother. This year she goes to a party with Enrique. At midnight she kisses her son. Enrique hugs her back, hard. "Happy New Year. I love you," he tells his mother. For the first time in all her years in the United States, Lourdes doesn't cry on New Year's Eve. Honduras. Criticism of Maria Isabel by Enrique's family grows. Gloria's grandchildren play next door. They return and repeat everything they've overheard Enrique's family say about Maria Isabel. Jasmine, they say, is dirty and ill-cared for. The girl loves to build little houses out of mud behind Gloria's house. Maria Isabel changes her clothes several times a day. Still, in Gloria's disheveled home, where the back door is left open to the muddy yard, her efforts are futile. Enrique's sister says that Jasmin is barefoot, badly dressed, her hair uncombed. She is skinny and pale and often has a cough. Why, Enrique's family asks, did Maria Isabel stop breastfeeding her after 6 months? If Enrique sends money, why doesn't Maria Isabel take Jasmin to a good private doctor, not the public clinic? Maria Isabel cooks, cleans, and goes out on errands and purchases for Gloria's store. She walks Gloria's grandchild to kindergarten. She helps care for the four children in the house while Gloria tends to customers in her little grocery store. Belki understands Maria Isabel's dilemma. She, too, has always lived as a guest in someone else's home, feeling pressure to make herself useful. Still concerned about Jasmin, Belki hounds Maria Isabel. Why is the girl all dirty? You need to take better care of her. Sometimes Maria Isabel doesn't respond. Other times she bristles. No, I take care of my girl. They have no right to criticize. One of Enrique's aunts has a son who is just as skinny as Jasmin. Should she have to explain that her breasts stopped giving milk? If the women next door are so concerned about Enrique's interests, why did some of them treat him like a dog, she wonders, when he lived in their home? The women next door have another reproach. Maria Isabel is misspending the hard-earned money, $100 to $150 a month, that Enrique diligently sends his daughter. Maria Isabel spends most of the money on Jasmin. She also gives $15 a month to Gloria. She stocks Gloria's refrigerator with fruit, milk, and chicken. She gives Gloria's daughter's pocket change. She sends $10 across town to her mother to help her buy heart and asthma medicine. To the women next door, Maria Isabel is showering money on her family that rightfully belongs to Enrique's child. They know exactly how much she gets. Maria Isabel's money comes in a joint wire that Enrique and Lourdes send to one of Lourdes's relatives. Enrique's aunt Miriam vigilantly watches when Maria Isabel goes shopping, whom she goes with, how many bags they have when they return. Miriam, a hairstylist, hears that Maria Isabel has bought hair dye for herself and Gloria's daughters. Miriam is livid. She is so broke she can barely buy used clothes for her three children. When she visits Gloria's house, she sees a can of Jasmin's powdered milk spilled on the floor. Gloria's grandchildren are racing around with fistfuls of white powder in their hands. Another day, Miriam scolds Maria Isabel for paying $150 for a chest of drawers to store Jasmin's clothes. You were a fool to buy such an expensive piece of furniture. My cousin could have gotten you a better one for a third of the price, Miriam tells her. Maria Isabel seethes. She says nothing. She is grateful for what Enrique sends. Still, most of the money pays for diapers, clothes, medicine, and food for his daughter. Powdered milk alone costs $20 a month. Maria Isabel has spent most of her life deprived of decent clothing. Can't she buy a dress or splurge $2.50 to get her hair dyed? She cannot live with her Aunt Gloria, who is in financial distress, without helping. Miriam, a single mother, is desperate for money. Since the birth of her third child, she has cleaned a sister's house for $35 a month and food. As each of her children begins elementary school, Miriam's costs rise. They need books, supplies, and $1.50 per day for lunch at school. Enrique doesn't send me a dime, she moans. His only wire has been $20 on her birthday. She remembers changing Enrique's diapers as a baby, and how later, when he was a teen, she looked out for him. When Enrique was a glue sniffer living in his grandmother's house, she cooked his meals. Now, when she is in dire need, all of Enrique's money flows to the girl next door. She isn't spying on Maria Isabel, Miriam tells her family. She's just protecting Enrique's infant by demanding that Maria Isabel be a better mom. Does Enrique know, Miriam angrily asks her sisters, that Maria Isabel sends money across town to her mother? When Jasmin turns 8 months old, Miriam mails Enrique a letter. "Your daughter isn't being well cared for," she writes. "Maria Isabel is misspending your money. I've seen some of the clothes you sent Jasmin strewn in the dirt behind Gloria's house." Enrique recalls that when he visited Gloria's house, the children there were dirty. He asks Miriam to keep an eye on Jasmin. On the phone, he also chides Maria Isabel. "If you don't take good care of that girl, I will come to Honduras and take her away from you." For a moment, Maria Isabel is silent. Then her voice turns stiff. "No one takes my daughter away from me." Gloria is fed up with the digs at Maria Isabel, how her actions are scrutinized, how Enrique's family tries to control her. "Stop bothering Maria Isabel. You are driving me nuts. Stop criticizing her," she tells the women next door. Gloria's grandson Ayan plays rough with Jasmin, who is smaller. He picks her up by the waist and throws her to the ground. He bites her and pulls her hair. When Jasmin is 9 months old, Ayan plops her inside Gloria's green wheelbarrow. From the porch of her grandmother's home, Belki screams, "Ayan, leave the girl alone!" Ayan is already pushing the wheelbarrow. It tips. Jasmin tumbles to the ground. She wails. Maria Isabel is out on an errand. "Gloria, Ayan has thrown the girl off the wheelbarrow," Belki yells. Gloria snaps. She shouts across the dirt street that divides their homes. "You think this child is an assassin? All you do is talk shit. You stick your noses in everything," she curses. She tells them to mind their own business. Then she offers up Jasmin. "Here she is. Take her. You can raise her. Let Enrique send money to you," she says. "If the dollars are causing you to make all these allegations, keep the damn dollars." For months, the families don't cross the street or speak. But Gloria's grandchildren do. They hear the women next door say they think Maria Isabel is having an affair. When she's out doing errands for Gloria, they say, she's really seeing a boyfriend. Maria Isabel is enraged. They are sullying one of the few things she has, her honor. Whenever Maria Isabel sets off on an errand, one of Enrique's aunts steps outside and inquires across the street, "A donde vas? Where are you off to?" Jasmin will soon turn 1 year old. Lourdes and Enrique send $400 and instructions. They want a joint birthday party for Jasmin and Miriam's 1-year-old daughter. That way, Lourdes figures, there will be a video to send north of everyone together. Maria Isabel feels she is being forced to have her daughter's celebration with women who have maligned her as a bad mother. She has barely stepped into their home since Jasmin's birth. On Jasmin's birthday, Maria Isabel dresses her in the red dress and white shoes Enrique and Lourdes sent for the party. She sends Jasmin next door. Maria Isabel stays behind, sobbing. Gloria finally tells Maria Isabel that she should go next door long enough to be in the video for Enrique. Jasmin and the other children have already taken turns whacking her piñata. Maria Isabel arrives as Jasmin is blowing out candles on her Winnie the Pooh cake. She balances Jasmin on her hip, nervously adjusting her daughter's party hat. "Happy birthday to you," the children sing in English. Maria Isabel does not sing. She wipes away tears. A half hour after arriving, she retreats to Gloria's. Enrique has a short lull in work. He stops sending money. Maria Isabel finds a job sanding chairs at a small furniture factory for $35 a week. United States. A year after Enrique's arrival, Lourdes's boyfriend smuggles his 14-year-old son into the United States. The boy was 8 years old when his father left Honduras. That's when the boy started drinking and getting into fights. His father hopes that bringing him to the United States will straighten out the teenager. Instead, he finds new troubles. Teachers constantly call his father in to discuss his behavior. After 6 months, he drops out of school. Enrique blames the boy's father for his aggressiveness and penchant to fight. As a boy, Enrique says he never had a father to protect him. If his father had been with him, he wouldn't be that way, Enrique says. He wouldn't be in trouble. The teen and Enrique share a room and drink together. Lourdes fears that the boy is reinforcing Enrique's sense of abandonment. Enrique drinks more and more. His eyes are red from smoking marijuana. After work, he eats, showers, and goes out to play pool and drink late into the night. Enrique calls Maria Isabel less often, every 2 weeks, then every month. He tells her he wants to bring her to the United States in a year. But he hasn't saved any money for a smuggler. Enrique has never returned to his low, sniffing glue. Now, a few days before Christmas, 22 months after he left Honduras, beer and marijuana are no longer enough. He ends the workday by pouring a little paint thinner into an empty Pepsi can. He brings it home. He does the same the next night. The thinner doesn't give him as good a high as Honduran glue, but it's handy. Over the holidays, his family and others who share the trailer move into a newer three-bedroom duplex. It has a big kitchen and a living room with three sofas draped in lilac floral slipcovers. There is enough space to hang a painting of the Virgin of Guadalupe, a wooden carving of the map of Honduras, and a small American flag. Still, the home is crowded. There is little room for Enrique to hide his growing habit. Twice in 2 weeks, Lourdes has seen her son hold a smelly handkerchief over his nose. She never steps inside Enrique's bedroom. One morning, concerned that he hasn't gotten up for work, she walks in. She smells something funny, like paint. "What are you using?" she demands. "Nothing. Nothing!" She asks about the smell. Enrique yells at her. Lourdes senses that he is hiding something. For a few days, Enrique stays cooped up in his bedroom, listening to reggaeton music. He has been sniffing thinner for 2 weeks. One night, he decides to go out. He walks through the living room toward the front door. He is hiding something under his arm. "What do you have there? Show me," Lourdes says from the living room sofa. "None of your business." Enrique tries to brush past her. Lourdes jumps up and grabs Enrique by the shirt. She smells paint thinner. She's asked friends some questions. Now she knows what the smell means. Enrique shakes himself loose. Lourdes's words tumble out. She doesn't care that her boyfriend and three of his relatives are in the living room listening. "You're broken, ruined, a drug addict. Why did you even come here? To finish screwing yourself up?" Enrique curses. "You're a disgrace. Get your act together. Instead of seeing you this way, I wish God would take you from me," Lourdes says. "If you keep sniffing thinner," Lourdes tells him, "you have to move out." She must think of her daughter. Enrique does not respond. He peels out of the gravel driveway in his car. Lourdes is despondent. She worries that he will kill himself driving recklessly. For the first time in her life, Lourdes feels as though she wants to die. Maybe if she were gone, she tells herself, Enrique would know what it is truly like not to have a mother. That night, Enrique realizes that his body cannot withstand the thinner. Each time he inhales it, the left side of his head, where he took the worst of the beating on top of the train, aches badly. His left eyelid, which still droops slightly from the assault, pulses and twitches. He has excruciating pain when he turns his head. He stops sniffing. He's not doing it because his mother wants him to. He is doing it for himself. He focuses on his old habit, drinking. One morning at 2 a.m., Enrique is caught doing 55 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. He gets tickets for speeding and having an open container of beer in his car. The sticker on his license plate is expired. Police give him a breath test. They impound the car and take him to jail, where he spends the night. Lourdes sends her boyfriend to bail him out. Enrique's license is revoked for a week. Many of the men in his paint crew drive drunk, nearly four times as many Hispanic drivers as non-Hispanic drivers in North Carolina have been charged with driving while impaired. Enrique's workmates tell him not to worry. The government, they say, just wants you to pay a lot of money and tell a judge you are very sorry. The real problems, they tell him, begin with your third arrest. Enrique pays an attorney and the government $1,000. He tells a judge he is very sorry. Honduras. Life in Gloria's house has turned tense. Maria Isabel moved in because it was less crowded than her mother's hut. Now, 12 people crowd Gloria's two-bedroom house. Maria Isabel shares a bedroom with 5 others. Gloria's store has gone bust. The only other one in the house with a job is Gloria's husband, who makes $125 a month. Her salary plus what Enrique sends isn't enough for Maria Isabel to support 2 households, Gloria's and her mother's. She has to get away from Enrique's sister and aunts. Slowly she has come to hate them. "I can't take it anymore," she tells Gloria. She'll return to her mother's primitive hut, she decides. Her mother and younger sister will help provide Jasmine, now 1.5 years old, with better care. She arranges for Enrique to send money for his daughter directly to herself instead of through his family. She does not give Enrique's family next door an address where she can be reached. Maria Isabel's mother, Eva, lives in a hut perched on a mountainside in a neighborhood called Los Tubos, 8 square blocks named after an above-ground water pipe that carries water from holding tanks on top of the mountain to Tegucigalpa below. On top of the mountain, Tegucigalpa's highest, shrouded in wisps of clouds by day, bathed in an orange glow of lights by night, stands a towering statue of Jesus. The gray statue stretches out both arms. They reach down toward the residents of the city below. The road up to Eva's is so steep that many cars can't get up it. Then there is a rutted dirt road, followed by a narrow mud and clay trail that zigzags upward. Maria Isabel must use the roots of a large rubber tree to step up to her mother's tiny wooden hut, which clings to the hillside. 9 people sleep inside. There has been one improvement since she left 6 years before. A relative built a small cinder block house next door. It has a bathroom, which Maria Isabel's family can use. Most children in Los Tubos don't go on to junior high because reaching the nearest school requires bus fare. Men work as bricklayers, women clean houses in wealthy neighborhoods. Still, as one of the city's oldest neighborhoods, it is a small step above where Gloria's and Enrique's families live. Water, which flowed through the tap every 2 weeks in Gloria's house, is available here every other day. Many wooden huts have been upgraded to small brick or cinder block homes, some 2 or even 3 stories high. Their windows have glass panes instead of wooden shutters. Almost everyone has a refrigerator. Most in Los Tubos are long-time residents, but Maria Isabel's family are relative newcomers. They bought a lot in 1980 as homes were being built farther and farther up the hill. Above Maria Isabel's hut, there are mostly lush green slopes where it is too steep to build even the smallest place. Maria Isabel's family, among the poorest in Los Tubos, eats twice a day. They have no refrigerator. They cook on two small burners. All that has kept disaster away has been Maria Isabel's oldest sister, who sends money from Texas where she lives. Still, Maria Isabel's life gets better. 6 days a week at 11 a.m., Maria Isabel sets out for her new job at a children's clothing store at the Mall Multiplaza downtown. From the back of the store, sales girls ask Maria Isabel for a certain shoe and size. She fetches it. She shoves the box through a small opening in the wall. The light-filled mall, where Tegucigalpa's well-heeled citizens shop, has beige marble floors, potted indoor palms, air conditioning, and glass elevators. She gets home at 10 p.m. The job pays $120 a month. Jasmin puts on weight. Both Maria Isabel's mother and her younger sister care for her, while Maria Isabel works. Jasmin plays with her six dolls, giving them baths in an outdoor concrete trough the family uses to hold water. She brushes the doll's hair. Afterward, she runs inside. "I bathed the baby," she announces to her grandmother, a wiry, muscular woman with salt-and-pepper hair. She chases her grandmother's black-and-white chicks, making them scurry across the kitchen floor. She plays dress-up with a five-year-old girl next door, or Agua de Limón, where they lock hands and swing each other around in circles. When Jasmin gets hungry, Eva scrambles her eggs with black beans. She changes her whenever she gets dirty. In the afternoon, Jasmin goes to her grandmother and demands money. "Quiero pisto." Eva hands her a little change. Jasmin crawls down a steep flight of stairs to a tiny bodega below. She peers through the black iron bars on the door and points. "Those, I want those," Jasmin says. The store owner hands her a small bag of hot pork rinds. Jasmin makes her way back up the steep slope. Each day, the girl reminds Maria Isabel more and more of her father. Like Enrique, she stands slightly knock-kneed, her pelvis thrust out, her bottom tucked under. She has his deep, raspy voice. She has the same temperament as Enrique and Lourdes. She is testy, a stubborn fighter who stands her ground. When she turns two, Maria Isabel takes Jasmin to talk to her father on the telephone. Jasmin loves to accompany her mother downtown on Sundays, to the Ashti's cell internet, where they can dial Enrique more cheaply. Maria Isabel knows his number by heart. She sits before the gray computer, and Jasmin stands between her legs. "Mom, pass the phone," Jasmin demands, reaching for the computer headset. "I love you, Enrique," she says. Then, "When are you coming here?" Jasmin returns to her grandmother's and proudly announces, "I spoke with my daddy, Enrique." Often the things Jasmin tells her father are lines that Maria Isabel prods her to say. "It doesn't matter," says her grandmother. "They are strangers," says Eva. "But they are blood." Eva often shows Jasmin the 8 photos Enrique has sent of himself. Jasmin knows her father sends her things. When Enrique's aunt Rosa Amalia asks her where she got the beautiful gold and emerald earrings she wears, Jasmin touches them. "They are from my daddy Enrique," she adds. "He says he loves me a lot." Eva tells Jasmin that someday she will go see her father in an airplane. Jasmin figures her father must have left on an airplane, too. Several times a day when she hears one in the sky, she stops what she is doing and races outside. She looks up, her eyes bright. She thrusts both arms up and waves madly. "Adios, Papi Enrique," she yells. United States. Enrique has been living with his mother for nearly 2.5 years. One evening, Lourdes and her boyfriend are watching a soap opera on the living room television. Enrique and a friend are playing cards down the hallway on the kitchen table. Enrique is wound up tight. He's working at a company that pushes everyone to paint excessively fast. Enrique and his friend throw the cards down hard on the kitchen table. Each time they slap a card down, they yell. Lourdes walks into the kitchen. She looks cross. "What are you doing?" she demands. "If you don't want noise, you should live alone." "You're an ignoramus," she answers. Enrique likes to goad his mother by making noise. At dinner, he burps loudly and doesn't excuse himself. He bangs his spoon on the kitchen table. He slams doors. He plays music at high volume. He yells. He thinks it is incredibly funny to see her get mad. Lourdes goes back to the television. Enrique and his friend slap the cards down harder and harder. Lourdes stomps into the kitchen. Her boyfriend knows trouble is near. He soon follows. "Be quiet," she orders. Enrique answers badly. "You must respect me. Don't forget I am your mother. I gave birth to you." "I don't love you as if you were my mother. I love my grandmother." "I gave birth to you. That's not my fault." Lourdes grabs Enrique's shirt around the shoulders. Enrique pushes his chair back and bolts up. Lourdes slaps him on the mouth, hard. Enrique grabs her two hands near her neck to prevent further blows. Lourdes assumes that he is trying to grab her throat. "Let go of me," she screams. Lourdes's boyfriend pulls them apart. Then he ushers Enrique outside. Enrique is crying. By the next day, all has returned to normal. Once, Enrique would have apologized. Today, there are no words of regret. With others, Enrique is openly affectionate, especially with his half-sister Diana. He gives her money, drives her to the store, plays piggyback with her, caresses her cheek. He teaches her to dance. They play rhymes together. Unlike Diana, who can be selfish, Enrique is generous. "I have a secret to tell you. I love you," he tells her. Still, with his third New Year in the United States, Enrique resolves to change. He can no longer wallow in what happened in the past. He must live in the present and for the future. He's not hurting Lourdes as much as he is hurting himself. Drinking so much alcohol makes his stomach ache constantly. He's tired of going to work after spending all night out drinking. He wants to look better when Maria Isabel comes to the United States. Most important, he has to be more responsible for Jasmine. He can't have her grow up worrying about money as he did. He wants her to study. He can no longer blow hundreds of dollars in a single night of partying, or thousands on troubles with the police. That has been a huge waste of money. If he doesn't change, he will repeat his mother's mistake. Time will slip by, and Jasmine will grow up without him. He must save $50,000 as quickly as possible to buy a house and start a business in Honduras. Enrique starts working 7 days a week. Bit by bit, he cuts back on beer and marijuana. He used to go out 3 or more times a week. Now it's just once or twice a month to play pool. He drinks a few beers, then switches to Pepsi. When friends call on his cell phone, beckoning him to party, he tells them he's not interested anymore. He stops playing his music loud and slamming doors. When he burps, he excuses himself. He eats dinner with Lourdes. On Saturday nights, they watch the Spanish-language variety show Sábado Gigante together, as they did when he first arrived. He tells friends he'll quit beer and drugs altogether when Maria Isabel is at his side. He hopes to bring her next year, get married. He cuts his hair really short and loses weight. He wishes he could fix all the lingering effects of his beating on the train. The scars on his forehead and knees. The bump under the skin by his left eye. The pain in his teeth any time he eats anything hot or cold. Maybe he can at least get caps put on his broken teeth. Honduras. Lourdes's sister, Marianne, is in trouble. She is out of work. Her sister, Ana Lucia, offers her $50 a month to take care of her youngest child. The money falls short. Only another sister, Rosa Amalia, holds hunger at bay. Each Saturday, she brings Enrique's grandmother milk, cheese, butter, rice, sugar, beans, and